A reminder to sign in if you have not yet done so, and then we're ready when you are, gentlemen.
May it please the justice and this honorable court, tell the court in advance I'm fighting a cough, and I've got a cough drop in. I hope that does not offend the court. And I have another one in my pocket in case I need to go for it.
You won't offend us unless you infect us, I guess.
I'm not contagious, Judge. I've already checked that from my doctor.
Fine. And do you care to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Although I anticipate we can get through this quicker than that, Judge.
All right.
May it please this court and the honorable justices, I'm here. My name is David Cyphers. I'm here representing Heather Hoxton Lambert. I know the court is well familiar with the facts, but I will set the stage for my argument. Heather Lambert was a special ed teacher who holds a master's degree in early childhood education with considerable experience and training. She had extra classes she took. She taught in Fairfax County, she taught in Maryland, and then she moved to Scott County, Virginia. She took a position there as a special ed teacher, and she took the position on this particular day, being the 10th day of January 2013, that once a teacher, always a teacher. Whether you're on bus duty, whether it's your student or not your student. That morning, a young lady got off the bus who had special needs. She left some of her articles, and that was in dispute, there. An aide was there. The aide took no action. Now, we need to preface this by saying there's no indication that Mrs. Hoxton, or Ms. Lambert, had any ill will toward any student there, not this student in particular. It wasn't like this kid had spit in her face and she was retaliating. It wasn't like this kid had done something just terrible to her and she was looking for an opportunity to get even.
This case really boils down to whether or not we would be able to say as a matter of law that the conduct in this instance was either incidental, minor, or reasonable, correct?
And I think, given the facts of this case, I'm exactly asking the court to do that. I'm saying that this isn't a question of fact, that the trier of fact should differ on this case. I submit, given the facts, and you have the video in the record of what happened there, that given the statutory construction under 18.257 and what the legislature has specifically outlined as an exception to the assault and battery conviction, that under these facts more has to be shown as a matter of law, because the facts are basically undisputed. As a matter of law, more has to be shown than was shown here to convict a teacher. Now, whether she should be subject to disciplinary action through the school, some sort of action there, that's it, totally irrelevant to this case. The question is, can she be convicted under 57.2 of assaulting this student?
In the circumstances of this case, when we look to that element of reasonableness that's set forth in the exception, subsection G, does the school board letter that came into evidence, and I realize that's a matter of, that's an issue as well, but does that letter bear on this issue of reasonableness?
I have a two-pronged response.
Yes.
One, it should not have been considered by the trial court.
I understand.
And that's the first thing. And secondly, if you read the letter in detail, it says she should not put her hands on any student except to maintain control and discipline, which is the statutory language. I actually have a third response, and that is the school board cannot supersede what the legislature has said as a standard. That's why I say if they want to say she violated a directive of the school board, they can fire.
Well, then it seems to me, it sounds like we can all agree that if we were talking about anybody but a teacher, we wouldn't have any question about this being an assault and battery. So the only question is, does the in loco parentis relationship, the statute, you know, obviously permits a different standard to apply. Whether as a matter of law, the conduct here was incidental, minor, or reasonable, and any one of those three could work, I guess would be your argument.
Absolutely.
Who decides that, though? I mean, isn't that a fact finder's role ultimately, is to determine if, for example, a particular touching or assault, if you will, is incidental, or I guess another way to phrase that might be accidental, as opposed to, or whether it was de minimis, a minor in that sense, or reasonable under the totality of the circumstances.
To a certain extent, but the legislature's also given the court guidance in how it's supposed to judge that. And in particular, they say, and determine whether a person within exceptions providing this subsection particular a teacher, due deference shall be given to that teacher's judgment at the time of the event, not Monday morning quarterbacking, not where some trier of fact sits back and says, I don't know if I would have done that.
Well, it says due deference shall be given. Now, does that mean that they're required to accept whatever explanation a teacher, for example, offers? So,
absolutely not. But under the facts of this case, there's no evidence that she wasn't acting in the best interest, what she considered to be the best interest of the child. If you look at the video, she takes the child by the wrist and around the waist, which is the way she was taught to do it, because as she explained, children with special needs will often go to the ground. And what when she made the decision that this child, in the child's best interest, may please the court, the easy thing for a teacher to do would be just to say, it's not my problem, and walk away. This teacher made a decision that what was in this child's best interest was to make her come back out and pick up her book bag or her personal item, whatever nature it was. The interesting thing is that even the Commonwealth's own evidence indicated that the aide said, at some point in time, I would have made her do that. Well, this lady, reasonable judgment inferred, said it's important that we act now, because what we're doing is reinforcing negative conduct by this child, which is proactive to prevent loss of control and order. Under the facts of this case, this teacher was acting by her testimony and by the testimony of the aide. And she did an act that the aide would have eventually made this student do anyway. She would have made her come back out. You can look at the video, her force is very reasonable. And may it please the justices.
Well, on that issue of the reasonableness of the force, and my hat is off to special needs teachers. They do an amazing job under the circumstances. But wasn't there testimony from the principal or someone who had provided the, I don't know if it was MANT training or what, but training on how to deal with these? Wasn't there testimony that Ms. Lambert had not used the holds or the techniques that had been taught at the school?
She did testify that there was some difference in what they did, but that wasn't Ms. Lambert's testimony. It was exactly the training she had received. And so, again, we get back to the question, the only thing this child had as far as any injury was concerned, other than being upset, and any child's going to be upset when you enforce discipline, is a small red mark on the wrist where the child went down to the floor. There's no evidence of any excessive force here. There's no, whether her technique fit within what that particular school board person said should have been it fit within the training she'd been given, and it was not excessive or unreasonable given the circumstances she found herself in. Now, may it please the justices, the legislature's told us here, they've said in that 18.257, we've carved out this exception. They've not only told us there, they've repeated it in two other statutes, although similar, civil in nature. They have told us the very same language when it applies to complaints with the Department of Social Services, and when we define what corporal punishment is. They've given that same exception in two other statutes. So there can be no doubt what their intent was. The language I submit at the end of the statute, which says at the time of the event, is also crucial. Again, what we've got is a trier of fact sitting back and Monday morning quarterbacking and saying, I don't know that I would have done that. I think I was asked a question. I was going there a minute ago and I wanted to respond to the question. I don't know that I'd done it that way. That's not the question. there's no indication of malice. There's no indication of ill will. There's no indication of anything here other than a motivation to do what this teacher, due deference being given to her judgment, was what she thought should have been done. Now, the letter that was received from the school board. It's more toward bad, prior bad acts, and the trier of fact was there. It shouldn't have been considered, but I submit to the court that I think what happened here, I would submit, reading between the lines, is he convicted her because of that letter. You've been told once, even though it should never have come in. I'm not going to tell you twice. And he did not pay attention to what the statute says. The statute is very clear about what happened here.
Do I understand your argument on that letter? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to make it simple in my own mind. That because the statute is what places limits on what teachers can or can't do with regard to possibly assaulting a student, the letter expressing whatever the school board's policy is not relevant.
It's not relevant to this. The school board policy and their position that she shouldn't do something is not relevant to a subsequent act by her pertaining to whether she committed assault and battery on January 10, 2013. Does that answer the court's question? I've gotten far afield.
And you're in your rebuttal time, just so you're aware of it, sir.
We've heard the rest of that.
All right, very well, thank you. Mr. Shandoval?
Please the court. For the Commonwealth in this case. As I understand it, the crux of opposing counsel's argument seems to be that as long as Ms. Lambert was well-intentioned, and as long as she was attempting to control the behavior of her student, she could do just about whatever she wanted in terms of having physical contact with that student, as long as her heart was in the right place. And I would simply assert that the statute does not require us to judge her heart. I'm not here to judge her heart. But that simply cannot be the law. The statute does not claim that that is the law, does not state that that is the law, and this court has held in similar contexts, Carpenter versus Commonwealth in particular, in dealing with Virginia's corporal punishment statute, is that that deference that is to be given to the individual exercising that discipline or that instruction, that deference is not absolute. Judgment call does not start and stop with the individual making that determination. The statute states that teacher is entitled to due deference, not absolute deference. So it is falls to this court to determine whether or not this teacher was due any deference in this particular circumstance.
Well, how do you interpret the language in subsection G of the statute that basically says it's not assault and battery does not include school employees who are acting in the course of their official capacity and engage in incidental, minor, or reasonable contact? Is that who decides what's incidental, minor, or reasonable? The school board, the teacher, the average, reasonable person? Who figures that stuff out?
Well, I think that ultimately the trial court has to make the determination, obviously, but in determining what is or is not reasonable, you look at a totality of the circumstances, as we do in most contexts, and you can consider how did the school board respond to this sort of behavior.
Well, for example, the school board letter, let's assume the school board letter forbids a teacher from touching a student for any reason that doesn't, except for instructional purposes. So arguably the school board letter is more restrictive than the statute. If a teacher were to, notwithstanding that letter, touch a student outside of instructional purposes, maybe didn't result in a red mark or anything like that, but it was an intentional touching of some sort, and there was no indication it was for instructional purposes, would that be an assault and battery in the abstract?
I think that ultimately, under the statute, that determination still has to be made by the courts. And it certainly would have been a reasonable fact for a fact finder to consider the fact that the school board had said, you cannot do this. In our judgment, this is proper discipline of a child, and this is improper discipline of a child. The trial court should give a lot of weight to that statement by a school board in determining what was or was not reasonable. But I don't think the school board necessarily gets to determine for once and for all how Virginia's statutes are going to be applied and enforced.
Well, the touching in this case certainly was for instructional purposes. Do you agree with that?
Again, I'm not here to... I guess the statute says incidental, minor, or reasonable physical contact designed to maintain order and control. It does seem like Ms. Lambert was attempting to maintain order and control over the child. So I think the crux of the issue is whether or not her attempts for her physical contact was incidental, minor, or reasonable in this particular context.
And the reasonableness you're submitting is an objective standard depending on all the circumstances of the case. And if I'm following correctly, Ms. Lambert's position is that it's a subjective determination. She's trained as a professional, and so she needs to be able to exercise her own judgment on what's appropriate under the circumstances.
That's my understanding. That's my position, my understanding of Ms. Lambert's.
Let me explain his hypothetical then, or his question. Hypothetically, if I were a teacher and a student was, special needs student was acting up and disrupting the class, and the decision I made was to escort that student to the principal's office, and that student didn't want to go, and I took that student by the hand or by the arm and walked her out the door, and she was kicking and screaming and fighting me the entire way, and in that, you know, mode we wound up at the principal's office, and I basically turned her over to the principal. Who decides whether or not my actions were reasonable? Clearly, I, you know, probably arguably violated the school board's policy by doing that. But is it for a trial court or a fact finder in a trial court, judge or jury, judge sitting without a jury or a jury to decide whether or not that was reasonable?
I would assert that ultimately the fact finder has to determine whether, as a matter of law, it was reasonable.
Well, and that ties into the other assignment of error, it seems to me, which is then what possible relevance does that letter have?
I think that'd be a question for opposing counsel, most likely.
No, I'm asking you. What it was introduced for the purpose of basically showing what the policy, what kind of conduct was expected. And I guess my question is, if, having heard your answer to the hypothetical, that it's up to the fact finder to decide in the totality of the circumstances what's reasonable or not, what possible relevance does the school board letter saying our policy is you don't touch the students at all have to anything?
Well, as I argued moments ago, the ultimate legal conclusion as to whether this was reasonable behavior has to be made by a fact finder. A school board is not entitled to make that judgment once and for all and then bind all
and I agree with that, but then it seems to me that the letter doesn't have any relevance. If it's a totality of the circumstances based on you're a teacher, these are the circumstances, a reasonable judge or a reasonable jury will decide whether what you did was reasonable or not reasonable. That's the end of the analysis. Why do we need letters from school boards saying here's what you should or shouldn't be doing?
Well, one, I argue we didn't absolutely need it, and its admission was harmless. But in terms of the relevance of the letter, first of all, I would submit that when you make a reasonableness determination, when a fact finder is called upon to decide whether certain behavior was reasonable, that fact finder is entitled to consider the community and the context and the circumstances in which that decision was made. And part of what informed the circumstances in this case is that the school board had said, we do not allow you to discipline your children in this particular way. And I think more fundamentally, more important than the letter that was sent beforehand was the response of the school board after the fact in viewing the video and deciding in response to what was on the video, we are now going to send Ms. Lambert a letter of termination. That was their judgment of the reasonableness, and it certainly—
You're saying that the school board should have positive import into determining the standard of reasonableness.
I'm saying that the school board's
opinion is— Well, wouldn't you end up possibly with dozens of different policies because another school board might have a different policy? And I guess they maybe couldn't come into Abington, was that Washington County, establish the standard, but you could have a different standard up in Augusta and something else in Northern Virginia. And certainly you don't have a state statute where the standard of reasonableness varies depending upon what the school board thinks it should be. So it, do you really get, do, and isn't it unusual that somebody gets in when you're trying to resolve what is reasonable, that somebody can come in and says, in my opinion, this is what's reasonable? I don't know that we have that kind of evidence coming in.
Well, the
and so why should the school board get to establish what the fact finder is supposed to determine?
Well, two answers. First of all, I don't think the school board's opinion establishes anything. I think that that is a circumstance and a fact that the trial judge or the jury is entitled to consider in determining under the statute, under the law, whether this was reasonable. But I don't think the school board decides anything. I do think it's relevant, though, because if you have a school board of a school of special needs kids, and that school board determines this is appropriate behavior in our judgment, this is how we expect you to act, that is relevant information that can inform that fact finder.
It's kind of, it gets to come in like you get an expert can give an opinion, though normal witnesses can't.
And maybe I should have began.
Is it equivalent to that?
I'm not making that argument. I don't believe it's equivalent to that. I think it's just another circumstance.
It sounds like the argument, I mean, following up on Judge Baumgartner's question, which I think is goes to the heart of this, clearly the school board's entitled to set whatever policies it wants to set. And if the teacher doesn't follow it, they can discipline the teacher. They can fire the teacher, don't renew the contract, whatever. That's a different question from whether something is a crime in one jurisdiction versus another jurisdiction. And if the school boards are allowed to set the parameters of what constitutes a crime, that's troubling to me, as it obviously this is Judge Baumgartner. So that's the distinction I think that's being drawn here.
I understand the distinction. And again, my position is that the school board does not determine what is or is not a crime. I would also assert that to the extent that this court believes the trial court may have relied upon that school board letter, if you look at the reason why the trial court admitted the letter into evidence, he stated that the reason for admitting the evidence on page 161 was just to determine whether or not the school board had told her its expectations and whether she was allowed to put her hands on a child or not, disciplining a child. And that does go to, if the court determines that reasonableness is not a proper, the letter cannot go to reasonableness, it still does go to the course and scope of her official capacity, because the school board does have a say over the course and scope of its teacher's official capacity.
The trial court, if I recall correctly, made a ruling that she was outside the scope of her employment. Did the court?
That she was outside the course and scope of her official capacity.
Is that your position?
My position is that because of, I think the easiest way to resolve this case is to hold that she was neither reasonable, incidental, or minor. This physical contact, grabbing a girl by the arms, dragging her down the sidewalk, pushing her, pulling her, yanking her, almost pulling her onto her face so she had to catch herself before she went down. The trial court properly held that that was not incidental, minor, or reasonable physical contact. And that really ends the analysis.
Well, that's confusing to me, because if she's outside the scope of her official capacity, stop, do not pass go, do not collect $200, you stand no different than anybody else in terms of committing an assault and battery. If you are, however, within your official capacity, then the question, you don't even get to incidental, minor, or whatever until you determine whether or not they're in their official capacity as a school employee.
The scope, if we were in the context of a civil action for money damages, for example, certainly she was acting within the scope of her employment as a special needs teacher for the school district.
Well, and I will confess to the court that my experience in workers' compensation cases is not very extensive, and yet I do
I'm
think...
I'm sure it's going to help you here anyway.
It might not. But there are times when employees go above and beyond the course and scope of their official capacity because they do things that their employers do not call upon them to do not require them to do.
But that's not the case here. A special needs teacher, a child, a teenager with Down syndrome, special needs, there's instruction that has to go on, and there, and in fact, the wasn't it the assistant principal had talked, Ms. Wood, talked about the training that is provided, because that's part of what a teacher does in the context of special needs education.
Correct, Your Honor, and she also testified that Ms. Lambert went above and beyond and outside the scope of that training, that the way that she handled the situation was not proper proper technique under the training that she's been provided. And so I would submit that the trial court was correct, that she exceeded the course in scope of her official capacity by going above and beyond how she had been trained to handle these types of situations.
And the testimony from Ms. Wood was that she provided the training for the, quote, handle with care technique that educators are required to use in Scott County.
Correct, Your
Honor. It was Ms. Lambert, and I realize that Ms. Lambert had training and experience elsewhere. Is the training different in Fairfax? And
there's
is that
testimony in the record, I believe, from Ms. Wood, the assistant principal, that Ms. Lambert had been trained in this particular handle with care technique, and that she went above and beyond that. So I would submit that she was outside the course of scope when she went above and beyond how she'd been trained, and also that this was neither incidental, minor, or reasonable. Yelling, screaming at a child in front of her peers, in front of other counselors, we had eyewitness testimony of that. Dragging her by the arm, almost pulling her flat on her face on the sidewalk in order to get her to go back to a bus stop to retrieve a coat and a blanket that she had left with the teacher's aide. And the teacher's aide had no problem with that. And I would also submit that judging the reasonableness of what she did, the finder of fact is entitled to take into consideration the reactions of the other individuals who were there, who deal with special needs children on a regular basis, and who were shocked and surprised and uncomfortable with the way that Ms. Lambert handled this particular situation. So I haven't heard from opposing counsel whether he asserts that this was either incidental, minor, or reasonable. I provided the court with some definitions of those words from this court's case law and from the dictionaries. Incidental, occurring by chance or without intention. Clearly this was intentional physical contact. Minor is not serious, important, or dangerous. This girl had red marks on her arms, and she was emotionally traumatized for the rest of the day as a result of this and almost fell on her face. So I would submit it's clearly serious and also had an element of danger. Reasonable is just what is fair, just, ordinary, or usual under the circumstances. So in determining what is usual under the circumstances, I think a finder of fact is entitled to consider how did the witnesses who deal with these types of circumstances every day, how did they respond? Was this or was this not reasonable in their judgment? And clearly, the trial court made a factual finding that these three witnesses, all three were credible, that Ms. Lambert was not credible, and based on that, the court determined that she went outside the course and scope, that she was not reasonable, and that she exercised a lack of judgment. And trial courts are not required to defer to a lack of judgment in handling kids. So for all these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Your remaining time, Mr. Cyphers.
May it please the justices. I just want to add two or three things. One is, we have to remember, too, statutory construction. Any of these statutes are to be strictly construed against the Commonwealth, and if the court has any doubt, then you have to look at that in light most favorable, the statutory construction in light most favorable to the defendant. I never said Ms. Lambert could do whatever she wanted to do. If she had slapped this child, if she had pushed this child down, which you can watch the video, and she goes with the child, if she had kicked this child, we wouldn't be here today. We're here today because a teacher took a little initiative to do something that she thought was in the best interest of the child. Heaven knows that if she had it to do over with, she probably would have said, to heck with it. I'll let somebody else deal with that issue. But instead, she tried to take a little initiative and do something that was what she thought was in the scope of her employment. It clearly is within the scope of her employment. She's there on bus duty, and her duty is to maintain order and control. Whether she violates school board policy, again, is a civil issue that they can deal with another way. But to convict her of this crime under this statute, with the exceptions that we have carved, the legislature has carved out, I'd say is error, and I'd ask the court to reverse it or at the least remand it for a new trial.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of Fitzgerald versus the Commonwealth.